I moved from working in one of the theme parks in Florida to the Disney Cruise Line, which was one of these organizations, as I mentioned earlier, that was really not functioning at all well. And it had a lot to do with the culture. The culture being, you had a very strong Disney culture. You know, if you've been to a Disney theme park, you feel it. It's magic. And there's also a culture of the maritime culture. So it goes back thousands of years. And, you know, it was the idea, I think, of the Walt Disney Company that we'll just transfer that magic onto a boat, and then it will all be magic on the boat. Well, it doesn't really work that way.
You are listening to the Culture Coach Podcast. This is the place where CEOs and people-first leaders come to boost productivity, extinguish burnout, and cultivate a vibrant culture that reflects a fully integrated mission, vision, and core values. Get ready to take your culture to the next level. I am your host, Wendy Brand. Welcome back to the Culture Coach. My lineup of guests just keeps getting better and better. Hopefully you caught the episode with former CEO of WD-40, Gary Ridge, last week. My goal is to bring you leaders with lived experiences to prove that being intentional about culture can move the needle in your business. I don't want you to just take my word for it. And Gary certainly did that. My guest this week is no different. As a matter of fact, his insights and guidance were so magical that I created a two-part series to avoid having to cut out any of the goodness from our conversation and still make it an easy-to-digest episode. My guest this week is Greg Morley. Greg was most recently Global Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for Moët Hennessy. It's a division of LVMH. Greg brings a personal and professional passion to the development of talent and to helping others achieve more than they believe they can. A man after my own heart. Greg has had some pretty impressive leadership roles and impacts on culture transformation. Prior to joining Moët Hennessy, he was Vice President of HR Asia Pacific for Hasbro, and he was Vice President of HR for the Shanghai Disney Resort based in Shanghai. He's been based in Hong Kong, Paris, and the U.S. for the Walt Disney Company, and he started his career at General Electric. I mean, what better experience could there be? Greg also played a leading role in the team that brought the Gay Games, a global participant sports, culture, and diversity event to Asia for the first time in its 40 years history, specifically to Hong Kong. This first episode is about culture transformation, bringing different organizational cultures together, and the impact of creating a common language with core values. I hope you enjoy. All right. Welcome back to the Culture Coach Podcast. I am so excited about my guest today, Greg Morley. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Wendy, for having me. I'm just thrilled to be with you today.
Fantastic. Well, you have a phenomenal background that I want to hear more about, and I want the listeners to hear more about. So maybe tell me a little bit about kind of what you're doing today and how you got there.
Sure. I'm not sure I could have pointed from a point A to the point B where I am now to draw a straight line. And it certainly wasn't one, but maybe I could give some inspiration to people who are out there trying to seek their way forward. So currently what I'm doing is I'm spending a lot of time talking about a book I wrote, which is called Bond, Belonging and the Keys to Inclusion and Connection. And that book was really something that was born out of my experience having worked in a variety of different companies across different cultures, different industries. But particularly, I spent a majority of my career in human resources and in diversity and inclusion. And I gained a lot of insight through those functions, but also through the roles that I played in the importance of a strong culture, but also an importance of how culture looks very different across different industries, looks very different across different locations, geographies, contexts of business. And I was fascinated by that. I try to write a book that's very approachable, and it's informed. It's sort of a backward look because it's very much a storytelling approach to a lot of things that I had experienced. People who inspired me, I invited some people into the book, and now I spend time talking about the lessons that I learned, these keys that I developed, and trying to be a bit of an evangelist for inclusion and belonging in the workplace, which I think is important to individuals, but also critical to the success of businesses.
I 100% agree. And there's a lot we can talk about here. I am curious how you, because part of your background was in sales, and then you go to becoming a global HR and diversity and inclusion leader at Disney and Moët Hennessy. How did you make that jump?
I was blessed with great mentors and great leaders. If I look across the span of my career, having worked first at GE and then for many years at Disney, Hasbro, and then finally at LVMH, I really work for some great individuals and people that inspired me. But also, in a way, you know, great leaders can see things in you that maybe you can't, because they may have been through a journey that you haven't been through, or they're able to uncover things. And I had a leader when I worked for GE, when I was in the sales role, who had said to me one time, you know, I think you'd be very good in HR. And I had no idea what HR even was at the time, because I had been in sales and distribution and worked in a call center, all of these kinds of jobs. And I also think back on that, and I wonder if he was looking at me and saying, you'd be great in HR, or you're so bad at sales, you should probably go into something else. I don't know what the motivation was, but whatever it was, he saw something in me. And then when I joined Disney, I was first working in an operations role, not in human resources. And again, I had another leader who said, you know, you should try some roles in HR, try them out, see if they fit. And they fit. And I've always had a very business-minded side of my approach to HR. I, you know, came up through the business, I got an MBA, I went into HR, and I realized that I was very ill-equipped to be very good at HR from the technical side, maybe from the psychological side or the approach side. And so I went back and got a master's in HR. And then that equipped me, I think, to start to build a career in HR in different places around the world. And if I were somebody, like if I were talking to my sales younger self, I think I would encourage that person to take risks. Because when you're earlier in your career, as you start to build experiences and you start to, of course, we have to do well at our job. We can't just sort of stumble from one thing to another. But one of the things that served me very well was taking on roles that other people may not have. And because it was early in my career, I didn't have that. I never saw it as a particularly risky thing to go into a business that was failing, because I could learn something from that. And then you start to build a credibility about turning things around. And I think that's also where I started to build some competency and culture. Because oftentimes you go into a business, in my experience, the several times I went into failing businesses, it was very much driven by a dysfunctional culture. Maybe the business model wasn't working. Maybe there were some other technical things. But that was a foundation. And that's often where we started. And, you know, from that, I started to build a strong competence in that, which brought me to Paris and Hong Kong and Shanghai and back to Hong Kong and then back to Paris, where I live now.
Well, that is not a tough life.
It sounds easy, but you know, even in that kind of journey, I would say my other advice to my younger self would be, you know, marry a partner that's willing to play that game with you, because it's a sacrifice. I was very fortunate that I was raised in a family of parents who had lived overseas. So they understood, you know, the benefit of that for me, but also they understood that it would be a sacrifice for them too, because I would be away from home for extended periods of time. My mother in the beginning used to ask when do you think you're going to come home, move home? And I kept like home where you live, like where my kids' bed is, or home like the US, or what does home mean?
Yeah.
And eventually, I think this is maybe like 10 years ago, she said, I don't think you're ever going to come home, are you? I said, well, not here. No.
Well, and so tell me about the sales into HR and that, and then into the diversity world. Tell me about the work that you did there.
Yeah. So, You know, when I was a sales rep, one of the things that I got involved with was a organization design project, trying to figure out, you know, in GE, you had very distinct businesses, and the organization at the time was trying to leverage different businesses together. So I was assigned a project to kind of help the people that sold light bulbs work with the people that sold medical devices, finance it with a GE credit card, you know, all this kind of leverage and synergy, as the time the term was so huge at the time. And I was intrigued by that. You know, how do you motivate people to do something other than, you know, you want to do a good job or you want to get a sales incentive? And that led me into my role at Disney, because the guy that hired me at the time, who's still a very good friend of mine, he thought that was intriguing. Like, how do you get these organizations to build a culture around performance, not just, you know, one individual does a good job and the other individual does an okay job and somebody does a poor job, but, you know, you build culture around that. So that was how I got into it. And that was a lot of what I worked on earlier on in my career. I moved from working in one of the theme parks in Florida to the Disney Cruise Line, which was one of these organizations, as I mentioned earlier, that was really not functioning at all well. Mm-hmm. And it had a lot to do with the culture. The culture being, you had a very strong Disney culture. You know, if you've been to a Disney theme park, you feel it. Mm-hmm. It's a service culture. It's a hospitality culture. It's a welcoming culture. It's magic. And there's also a culture of the maritime culture. So it goes back thousands of years. And, you know, it was the idea, I think, of the Walt Disney Company that we'll just transfer that magic onto a boat and then it will all be magic on the boat. Well, it doesn't really work that way. Right. And so that was probably the first big significant culture project I undertook when I joined Disney Cruise Line as an HR leader, in trying to build a common culture. So something that was unique to that cruise industry or those cruise ships that maybe you didn't find necessarily on land, but you didn't find also in other large cruise companies. And then that, of course, that sort of led me, you know, back to this sort of taking jobs that other people didn't want to take. Somebody offered me to go to Disneyland Paris at the time, which was failing even worse than the cruise line was at the time. And I thought, well, that would be a great experience. Of course, it's Paris too, so it's not that hard to imagine going. But the same thing. I mean, it was an organization that was struggling because of financial issues, but they were layered on top of very deep-seated cultural issues that happened. And, you know, same thing, going to Hong Kong was the same thing, and one thing after another. But eventually I was in positions where I could start to lead and anticipate rather than cleaning up afterwards.
Mm. Yeah, that's so interesting. Some connections here. I don't know if you know, I worked on a cruise ship. I worked on a ship for a year, and then worked in their Miami office a long time ago, decades ago. But I understand the culture of the ship, right? It is very unique. And we were a Greek-owned ship, so very the Greek culture was integrated on the, you know, I mean, and there was no intention of changing that. It wasn't a Disney ship, you know, it was a different line, obviously. But and then the similarity too, I think, with, I understand going in, I worked in some mergers and acquisitions where I would go to another country that we had acquired a company in another country, and looking for those similarities, what in their culture can they keep, you know, that we don't want to take away because it'll change the way that they work. But what of our culture do we want them to take, so that we find that symbiotic, you know, balance there. But what can you share some of the things that you did to bring those cultures together or change the culture?
Yeah, I, you know, the cruise line's such a fascinating example, because you have not only is it like a hotel on the water, but it's also a home. You know, people, you lived on the ship for a year. It's not just, not the place you worked. It's the place you also lived and ate and slept and made relationships with people and all kinds of other things. You know, that experience was very telling for me and very formative for me. When I was appointed to be the head of HR for Shanghai Disney Resort, I had a lot of sort of these culture lessons burning in my mind. And one of the things that I believe still to this day is one of the pillars of why that project ended up being and that business is so successful is that from the start, we focused on building a Shanghai Disney culture, not a Disney culture, not a Chinese culture, not a Shanghai culture, but a Shanghai Disney culture. So how did we do that? I think this is an instructive way of thinking about company culture, organization culture. Is everybody who joined that project had to go through a program, that everybody who was in leadership had to go through, whether they were a designer, a merchandise manager, and senior executive, whether they were working in California or in Shanghai, it didn't matter. And they went through a program that we developed called Doing Business in China. And what that program did was it allowed people to be themselves, because we all have a personal culture that we bring to work. And it created a common language understanding of common desired behaviors of people. And that was the language that we used as we went through the pre-opening time. And that can be quite a stressful time. There are a lot of deadlines. There's a lot of resource constraint. There's a lot of new, because Disney never had built a theme park in China before. Right. So there's just a lot of new things happening. We were able to rely back on that language we had created. And then that created a culture that was strong enough to be able to kind of, you know, go through these difficult times and ultimately have a very successful organization, which now, you know, in Disney is very much looked at as a place to learn from, and especially from this culture, very rich cultural mix that exists in China.
Yeah. I love the common language theme. I mean, that is something that I believe is really foundational to creating a culture, is defining the language, and then so that everyone, whether you're in Shanghai or you're in Orlando, or, you know, you're speaking a similar language. And that can be, you know, it can be at the individual level where you do strengths finders, so you understand each other better and you speak that language, or it can be core values. Did you call that language, was it core values, or did you call it something different?
It was the Hong Kong, it was the Shanghai Disney values.
Okay.
Now what's interesting about that work, and I had another experience with that in Moet Hennessy at LVMH, because when I joined there, it was right at the cusp of kicking off a cultural change program. The CEO, and it was a new CEO, had joined. He had come from the LVMH company, so he knew a lot about the group. But Moet Hennessy is a quite unique organization where you have, it's basically a conglomerate of brands. You know, you have champagne brands and whiskey brands and Hennessy cognac and Cloudy Bay wine and all this other stuff. So those all have very strong individual cultures. Many of them existed far earlier than its association with Moet Hennessy or with LVMH. So here you have, you know, you're trying to bring these values of those organizations into the company and try to build something common. Then, of course, you're operating across 60, 70 countries. So those, you know, cultures come into play. And of course, people bring their own individual cultures, as I said. And one of the things I learned over time, and I first really picked this up when I was working in Hong Kong Disneyland, when we were doing culture work, was the definition of words also is very culturally specific. So if I said to you, we want to be an organization of high integrity, you know, the word integrity in our, you know, Western American parlance does not translate over necessarily directly into the way a Hong Konger would say it, or a mainland Chinese person would identify as it. So this part of the work that's done is really important, because you could be saying the same word. We could say, yes, we all want to be a high integrity organization, or we all want to be a service organization. We all want to do our best. And then you start to say, well, what does that mean? What does integrity mean to you? Somebody says, well, you know, we mean that we don't break the law. And then somebody else says, well, we do what we say. So those are different things when it comes to that word. And so when you do culture work, I think I've seen it go sideways. Now, usually you can pull it back when you recognize that that's what's happening. But that's what's, I think, so rich about the work. And then, you know, that's sort of what also led me into an even greater appreciation of inclusion and belonging, because those things, those triggers are the things people hear and bring them into an organization, make them feel like, okay, you're saying the words that mean something to me. I want to be part of that company.
Yeah. Let's start talking about, I want to hear about the book and connection, because that's, I agree that creating those values or defining the behaviors, if you're clear about that in your, you know, even in your external messaging and as you attract talent, it gives the individual the opportunity to say, I align with that or I don't align with that. And then if you choose, and I have a personal experience with this, right? Because the money was so good, I didn't necessarily align with the values, but the money was good. So I took the job, and then there was friction throughout. So, but at least the organization was upfront about, here's who we are and this is what we believe in, you know? So tell me, I mean, is that aligned with kind of your thinking on creating connection, or talk to me about that?
Yeah. And I'll make an aside comment at the beginning and then talk a bit about that. One of the things that I experienced several times in my career was when the company was talking about, like, these are our values, or this is the kind of culture we have, and employees would say, actually, that's not who we are. So it's very important that in culture building, that we're very honest with ourselves as an organization. What actually are we? And so, you know, it's, as HR or leadership or consultants come in to try to help organizations through that, the first thing that's necessary is to diagnose, like, who are we now?
Yes.
And then maybe what kind of culture do we want? Now, getting to the what kind of culture we want, as I explained in the Moët Hennessy example, you know, that takes a lot of conversation with people to say, what do these words mean? What is the behavior behind those words? And in the beginning, it's very tough work, because oftentimes what I saw in that example was leaders didn't necessarily like what they heard about who the organization thought they were, not them as people, but the organization in general. And because you had all of these different organizations as part of one, they all had slightly different views on what this thing was. And so I think that sort of conversation and moving through, it's why, you know, when people say it takes 3 to 5 years to change a culture, that's true. It's to do it properly. Mm-hmm. There's the work to define who you are, the work to define where you want to go, creating the plan to get there. And then people seeing the actions of especially leaders. And I talk about this in the book, you know, leadership has an outsized importance in the term in how people look at what an organization wants to be, how they want to behave. If I see my leader and I can say, wow, he or she is behaving in the way we talked about, that's modeling a value of spirit of conquest or integrity or whatever the value was, then that starts to ripple. And I had an example of this where the CEO, who was this champion of this project, had told a story in a Pride event about his family. And there was a situation that happened in his family, and it was very relevant to the time. And it was very personal. And it was in front of, like, you know, 150 people at an event. And he had asked me earlier that day, because he had told the story earlier in the day to his much smaller group. He said, what should I say at this big event? And I said, you need to tell that story that you told at lunch. It's so compelling. And he said, nobody wants to hear that. And I said, everybody, that's the kind of story people want to hear. It's very authentic. I was at the bigger LVMH event later that week, and somebody who never even showed up at that meeting, who worked for a totally different maison in the LVMH group, said, "Oh, I heard your CEO told this story," and he had recounted the story almost word for word. I thought that's the impact of, you know, having values, behaviors, and people modeling them, especially at the senior level.
Yes.
And that's how culture change happens.
And you can't invent that. I mean, you can't make that happen. Either the leader believes it and is connected with that, or they're not. You can't force it, I think. You can't pretend that that's the value if the leader's not living it, I believe.
Yeah. I think I could, as a senior HR person, put a script in front of a leader and say, these are the things that you should think about talking about. That's a relevant role for HR or diversity inclusion leaders. Like, give leaders something to chew on. What I can't do is I can't be in every business meeting and say, hey, that was the right thing to do or not the wrong thing to do. And I worked for a leader who he retired in Moët Hennessy, and he was that guy. Like, we would have discussions about, okay, these are some things I think you should address. He would put them in his own words, but he would live them in every meeting. And even with the most junior people in the organization, he would live those values. And that created a culture that people followed. And you had, you know, across the region, maybe 500 little CEOs that were doing the same thing because they thought, okay, well, he's the boss. I should follow that lead, and I'm inspired by him, and those are the right things to do. And I feel that in this company, I want to be part of that company.
What I loved about this conversation with Greg is how grounded it was in real experience over decades and with incredible brands. So whether you're building your culture from scratch or trying to realign a legacy team, I think his insights are truly a value add. I hope you agree. Join me next week for part two, where we dive deeper into inclusion, belonging, and the framework behind Greg's most recent book. If you want to grab his book before the next episode, you can find the link in the show notes or connect with him on LinkedIn. You don't want to miss the second episode, so go to my podcast and Apple Podcasts and hit the follow button to make sure that you're notified when the episode drops next Wednesday. And if you want to join our free culture strategy sessions each month, go to culturecoachwendy.com/strategy sessions. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.